In the late 1950s, Sweden briefly had the world's fastest computer. And then in the 1960s, they produced computers good enough to beat even the vaunted IBM. An amazing start. Sweden might have been the computing leader of Europe, but unfortunately that did not last. In this video, we look at the birth and glory of Swedish-made computers with the story of Datasaab. I promise to only make one IKEA joke. But first, something about the Asianometry Patreon. I'll be raising the price of the early access tier to $12 a month at the start of 2025. It's been a while, and I think it's time. Early access members get to see new videos first, with selected references, and it really helps me a lot. Each pledge I deeply appreciate. Thank you, and on with the show. It is the 1930s, and the Swedish government is concerned about rising militarism in Europe. Prime Minister Per Albin Hansson felt that if war did break out, then Sweden had to be self-sufficient in weapons production. They had excellent shipyards and weapons factories. What they lacked was the ability to make warplanes. So, in April 1937, the government founded a company called Svenska Aeroplan Aktiebolaget, or Saab. The name literally means Swedish Airplanes Company. Saab took over the aircraft divisions of the Swedish Railroad Works Company and began building military aircraft, the first of which was the Svenska B-17, a versatile propeller dive bomber that debuted in 1940. Saab eventually produced some 325 of these planes, but when the feared war did break out, however, Sweden declared itself neutral. Their cooperation and vast reserves of iron ores spared the country from a German invasion. After World War II, however, we had the Cold War. The Saab aircraft division continued upgrading their capabilities, and in the 1950s, Saab would deliver four jet-powered aircrafts, including the Saab 29. In 1946, several defense organizations within the Swedish government heard reports about the ENIAC, which the United States had recently declassified. Immediately seeing the possibilities for cryptography and ballistic trajectory calculation, they sought more information. They sponsored a Swedish electrical engineering professor named Stig Ekelöf to go to the United States, one of the first such to go there since the end of the war. Ekelöf met with professors at Philadelphia and Princeton. Then he also attended the famous Moore School lectures in the summer of 1946, the first ever on the construction of digital computers. He returned to Sweden in September 1946, giving lectures to defense staff and writing articles about ENIAC's electron brain. The Swedish government decided that a general-purpose math machine would have profound benefits, not just for its military, but also for Swedish society as a whole. So in 1947, they founded the Swedish Board for Computing. The board sponsored some number of scientists, four, five, or six, the number varies, to go to the United States for a year and join various prestigious computer projects at Harvard and other big universities. Then in 1948, the Swedes tried to acquire a computer from the United States. However, export controls imposed after the Berlin blockade made that impossible. Thus, the board decided to sponsor the construction of two domestic computers built in parallel. The first to be completed was BARC, the Binary Arithmetic Automatic Relay Calculator. Finished in February 1950, it made Sweden, likely, the third country in Europe to develop its own computer after Britain and Germany, though who's counting? BARC was equipped with 5,000 electromechanical relays. These are electrically operated switches that work sort of like proto-transistors. They physically open or shut to break or connect a current. The whole device cost about $100,000 to build in 1950, or about $1.3 million today. Considering that Sweden's population was just about 6.5 million people at the time, this was a significant expense. BARC's construction was led by the scientist Connie Palm, who envisioned its potential use for controlling telecommunications traffic. Palm unfortunately died young in 1951 from a lung edema, a tragic loss. Like with previous punch card systems, various users, like university academics and government, were open to use BARC if they had the money. The largest user was the military, who used BARC to run ballistics calculations. Though they didn't get too much out of it, the only way to program BARC was using its 12,000-hole plug board, something resembling a telephone switchboard, an input method that took way too long. Bark was later dismantled in 1955 to free up space. The second finished device was the Binary Electronic Sequential Calculator, or BESC, completed in 1953. BESC used a stored program computer design, inspired by a famous American computer built for the Institute of Advanced Study by a team led by John von Neumann. One of BESC's lead designers, Eric Stem, had been a trainee at the Institute of Advanced Study while this computer was being built, so the similarity was not a coincidence. BESC was powered by 2,400 vacuum tubes, a ferrite core memory, and a cathode ray tube memory system. The latter two were older generation memory systems that existed before semiconductor memories or hard disk drives were invented. Users input programs into the system using a perforated paper tape, and then it spat output back at you using an electric typewriter. The BESC computer was made available as a timeshare, meaning that users would buy shifts to program instructions into the computer and have it run calculations. One early use case was numerical weather analysis of area maps and charts. I covered how computers revolutionized such weather prediction methods in the 1950s in an earlier video. Another use was running mathematical models simulating certain scenarios within Sweden's power system. A simulation that previously took 2 days on older analog calculators took just 15 minutes on BESC. BESC greatly influenced Scandinavian computing, and it was briefly the world's fastest computer, certainly the fastest in Europe. And the Danish built their own version of the BESC, and they named it DASK, which apparently means slap in Danish. That's pretty funny. I touched upon the BESC computer and its fate in an earlier video about Facet, a venerable mechanical calculator company. The government's unwillingness to provide long-term funding to the Swedish Board of Computing eventually led to its members' disillusionment, allowing Facet to swoop in and hire Stem and his whole team in 1957. Facet's new BESC boys, as they were called, built a copy of the BESC for them, the Facet EDB. But the company failed to capitalize on these talents, and the company's antique mechanical calculator business was later steamrolled by the advent of electronic calculators. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, Saab worked on a series of leading-edge jet aircraft. To design these high-performance aircraft, Saab's designers needed intense computation. They mapped the plane's entire body and wing with 3D coordinates, and then manually calculated lift and drag forces at each point to see how well the whole design flew. The Saab 32 Lansen design, done in the late 1940s, had a quarter of a million of these coordinate points. Running the calculations for all of them required a team of 30 calculator girls with slide rules and facet mechanical calculators. Then, in 1949, Saab recruited a 34-year-old mathematician named Börje Langefors. Upon his arrival, he implemented the widespread use of the finite element method. This is where we split a design into millions of simpler elements and then run individual simulations on each of those elements. Use of the finite element method grew Saab's computational needs by several orders of magnitude. Hungry for compute, Saab first built an electronic differential analyzer. This is an analog device, meaning that it used physical objects rather than digital bits to perform a calculation. Here in this case, wheels and disks. But Saab's designers wanted something more powerful, so they bought two IBM 604 electronic calculators, which used punch cards to run numbers. This and another subsequent IBM computer still failed to handle the task. So in the early 1950s, just after Bark was finished, Langefors reached out to the Swedish Board for Computing to see if Saab can get their own computer. The aforementioned Connie Palm told him that that would not be necessary because BESC, when completed, can fulfill all of Sweden's compute needs with just a third of its time shift. This turned out to be a dire underestimate, though not an uncommon one for the age. In 1953, after BESC's completion, Saab used a full shift right off the bat. Between 1955 and 1958, Saab by itself used 44% of BESC's total build time. They stationed four full-time staff nearby, frequently running it overnight, starting after 10 p.m. Over time, Saab became frustrated by having to share BESC with others, insert mildly offensive socialism joke here. So Langefors pushed his company leadership to make a computer of their own for internal use. So Saab licensed the blueprints and the expertise of the Swedish board's team for what is now 3.2 million Swedish crowns a year to build SARA. The name literally means Saab's arithmetic machine. Completed in 1957, SARA was mostly like BESC, except it had improved ferrite core memories and used a magnetic tape called SARA-band, one of the first in Europe to be implemented as such. The team's experiences building and using it led directly to their next computer. In 1959, the Swedish Air Force embarked on a new plane, the Saab 37. This design was an ambitious one. Earlier planes needed a pilot and a navigator, the latter dude for radar recon and other navigation duties. With the 37, they wanted to eject that navigator, figuratively, not literally, and have their tasks be handled by a digital computer presented to the pilot via a heads-up display. Moreover, the Air Force wanted to replace all the older and unreliable analog systems with new digital ones. The computer would have to handle that too, so a single integrated computer runs the whole plane. Can a digital computer be made small, light, and powerful enough to do all that? Yes, thanks to the recent commercialization of the transistor. A team at Saab, led by Viggo Wenzel, separate from the guys running SARA, was commissioned to build this. The computer was first called SANC, or Saab's Navigation Computer, and they thankfully renamed it to D2 and first unveiled it to the public in September 1960. D2 weighed about 150 kilograms and can add 2 6-digit numbers 100,000 times each second. Better than I can do. We can probably call it Europe's first transistorized computer, though being a prototype one-of-a-kind device, does it count? The D2 showed the Swedish Air Force that it was possible to have a single-seater fighter jet be run by a single computer. And the Air Force eventually commissioned the CK-37 computer from Saab for their plane, though later planes used an American design licensed and manufactured by Saab. And for Saab, it hinted at something even bigger. By 1960, it was clear that the computer was catching on. In 1955, Sweden had just one computer, BESC. 5 years later, there were 25. 2 years after that, 35. By 1963, 130 computers. So Saab's D2 and SARA teams joined to found a new division called DataSaab to commercialize the D2 design. As Saab's legendary CEO Tryggve Holm once said, "We woke up one day at Saab and found that we were computer manufacturers." Within the new division, Wenzel took care of hardware, Langefors, the software, Gunnar Lindström, a former nuclear physics professor who earlier made vital contributions to the MRI, became CEO. The D21, released in 1962, was DataSaab's first commercial product, a medium-sized mainframe for the data processing market in Sweden. As I mentioned in another video, computers for engineering or scientific work do a lot of calculations with a lot of precision, as in many decimal places, so they might need additional circuitry for longer registers. Data processing computers, on the other hand, do simpler operations on large amounts of data quickly and accurately, so they might use special circuits to shuffle around large amounts of data. The D21 descended from a military-oriented, high-powered engineering design that seemingly made it unsuitable for data processing. But Langefors boldly argued that the D21's fast and simple circuits and prolific memory, as well as a brand new high-level language called Algol Genius, made it suited for both markets. The first D21 was sold to Sweden's power utility in late 1960. Other earlier customers included city governments, insurance companies, shipyards, and Volvo. The D21 competed with similar offerings from Facet and IBM. The latter was one of the fiercest competitors in IT. IBM regularly beat domestic European computing companies with good marketing, deep relationships with IT departments, and strong technologies like disk drives. Buyers often wanted IBM at any cost. For example, while SARA was being built, Saab's own finance director asked if it could process admin data. At this time, this does not seem possible. A good way of sorting records had not yet been published, so the SARA team declined, saying the computer would not be fast enough. the finance director bought a slower IBM computer instead, which seems counterintuitive. To compete, Data Saab marketed deep customization and faultless operation. They equated it to flying and called it quote-unquote Saab service. They also included uptime guarantees that IBM was often not willing to match. Moreover, they regularly played the buy Swedish card. Most famously in 1964, the Swedish government did a King Solomon-style bake-off between the D-21 and IBM's 1401 for a computer system to be used by the country's Registration and Tax Collection Bureau. The D-21 proved to be faster and had higher capacity. But the Bureau clearly preferred IBM. They still decided to keep it half IBM, half Data Saab, but upgraded from IBM 1401s to System 360 30s, the lower end of the recently released System 360 line. After the computers arrived, the government's auditors again found that the D-21 computers were not only cheaper than the IBM System 360s, they still also performed better, thanks in part to the Algo Genius language, letting them use the very efficient Quicksort sorting algorithm whose code had recently only been published. Quicksort, in turn, relied on Algol's recursion ability. The auditors recommended to standardize on just Data Saab computers, which was done in 1970. It was a rare loss for IBM and one of the underdog Data Saab's greatest wins. Another one of Data Saab's greatest and longest-lasting achievements was his banking terminal business. In the four Nordic countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Finland, there are what are called savings banks. Founded with the goal of encouraging saving amongst the people, their local institutions owned by foundations. For the American viewers, I would probably equate them to credit unions. The savings banks in all the Nordic countries were experiencing rising administrative costs due to more expensive labor costs. So in 1960, they started a collaborative project to computerize all their savings banks and connect them to a single banking network, the idea being to make employees more productive and reduce costs. Each bank would have a mini-computer, which then powers many individual quote-unquote terminals that each teller can use. You can think of a terminal as like a monitor and keyboard that connects to a computer somewhere. This effort was called Nordisk Spar Data, or the Nordic Terminal Project. Data Saab collaborated with Facet, which provided peripherals like keyboards and printers, and together they bid for the project in December 1968. Over 10 months, Data Saab executives went back and forth trying to convince both the project joint committee as well as their own top executives back at Saab that this was a worthy project. The final deal was signed September 1969, beating out 14 other vendors. The terminal project demanded a mini computer powerful and flexible enough to meet the needs of four different countries' banks. The bid called for different types of monitors, keyboards, and displays. To meet these needs, they built the D520 mini-computer. Due to its limited ferrite core memories, Data Saab had to invent a new custom language called DIL5, which implemented all the Nordic Terminal Project's software in just 8 kilobytes. They delivered over 2,300 of these mini-computers for the project and eventually sold over 6,000 in total to other mutual savings banks, including a few in the United States. Data Saab was one of then Europe's biggest mini-computer makers, with 500 workers in 1976 producing 2,000 mini-computers a year, though sadly, the banking terminals were not that profitable for the company to produce. The end of Data Saab and its well-regarded businesses came slowly. In 1974, Data Saab took over Facet's old computer business from Electrolux, who themselves earlier acquired the whole company. Data Saab rebranded one of Facet's mini-computers as the Data Saab D15, eventually selling 320 of them. They also kept selling many of Facet's peripherals, which had been one of that business's few bright spots. But despite making a growing amount of money on service, Data Saab struggled to make money. The company started cutting off bits of itself, starting with the vaunted mainframe line. Their next big mainframe, the D22, was more powerful than its breakthrough D21, but sold only 70 units. So Data Saab halted production of its next D23 mainframe, and then in early 1975, sold the whole D20 line to the American computer company Unisys to form a joint venture called Saab Univac. The joint venture moniker was, of course, only a fig leaf. A few years later, in late 1980, Saab pulled itself entirely out of that business by selling its stake in Saab Univac to partner Sperry Corporation. In 1976, Saab finally had enough of the loss-making DataSaab's business prospects. With the aid of the Swedish government, they merged DataSaab with the computer terminal division of Standard Radio and Telephone AB and then spun it off as its own company, half-owned by Saab and half-owned by the Swedish government. The expectation was that the new DataSaab can rationalize and find some sort of synergy with its new partners, but they were still unprofitable, and in late 1979, they lost a second major banking terminal contract to Olivetti, despite being the favored incumbent. Partly because of dissatisfaction with the existing DataSaab product, the terminals were apparently not as good as initially hoped, as well as updating them would have cost a lot of expensive re-engineering, but more significantly, because of customer concerns that DataSaab the company wouldn't be around in 5 years to service the new terminals. This turned out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Losing a massive $100 million deal sent DataSaab into despair. That, and an embarrassing export control scandal in which DataSaab sent advanced American chips to the Soviet Union, opened the company up to acquisition in 1981 by Ericsson, the telecommunications company. Ericsson acquired DataSaab because they thought there was an opportunity to enter the quote-unquote paperless office space. By integrating DataSaab with some existing divisions to create Ericsson Information Systems, Ericsson felt that it could challenge IBM, Xerox, and Olivetti for the office automation market. They would expand from selling to telecoms to business firms and government agencies. One lasting legacy of DataSaab under Ericsson was how it collaborated with the Japanese company Omron to build the ATMs used across all the Nordic areas. And that's a nice legacy, but in the end, high R&D costs and low sales in light of the IBM PC boom caused the Information Systems division to turn massive losses. In 1985, they lost 806 million Swedish crowns, or 113 million US dollars, and the year after that, they cut that deficit to a mere 284 million crowns, or $40 million. In 1987, they sold the part of Ericsson Information Systems with DataSaab within it to Nokia, who then sold it to ICL 4 years later. I want to thank the former members of DataSaab, who clearly treasured the company's history and accomplishments. For a company I scarcely heard of before doing this video, DataSaab is one of the most thoroughly well-documented companies, with 5 books in the Swedish language. Check out the DataSaab Friends website. One of the reasons why the Swedish government and Saab built their own computers in the beginning was because it was otherwise impossible to procure the high-powered compute they needed. And for that reason, DataSaab flew ahead of its peers early on. But as it got easier to procure powerful general-purpose computers from outside vendors, particularly from Japan, customers, even the Swedish ones, were hard-pressed to go with the pricier DataSaab, even if it might have been more patriotic to do so. An unfortunate end to a promising start. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.